Hi guys, this is Life Through a Dram, and this week we'll be speaking to my friend Bob LeDrew, and we'll be talking about ukulele love, and that's not as kinky as it sounds, how music can transcend everything and really take you to someplace special, the intimacy of in-house concerts, and remembering a very special politician who did so much for his community and showed what real good politicians and people can be. Anywho, that's coming up on this week's show, so I hope you enjoy.
Welcome to Life Through a Dram, where Danny Brown shares his take on life, being a better person, and appreciating the here and now, all accompanied by a dram and a fine single malt whiskey. And now, here's your host, Danny Brown.
Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of Life Through a Dram, where we talk about, you know, life in general, being better people, all through the nice samplings of a good single malt or similar. This week I've got a guest on that I'm really excited to have on because he's got, I've known Bob for a while, Bob LeDrew, who's my guest. We go back a way back and we've shared a lot of tales and adventures, if you like. So I'm looking forward to hearing what Bob's been up to, and I know he's got some really cool stuff to share. So Bob LeDrew, the one and only, how about introducing yourself to the guests?
Hi, Danny, and thank you for asking me to be here. I am here, first off, to fulfill the requirement of a dram. I just poured myself a lovely 10-year-old Cull Illa Islay Malt. Ooh. Very nice, very peppery on the nose. Sorry. But yeah, my name is Bob LeDrew. I live in Ottawa, and I don't know what to say about myself. I am fairly passionate about music and words of various forms, and I work, I have a part-time gig at the Ottawa Public Library, and I enjoy that, and I enjoy doing some work in and around the music industry, the folk, mostly the folky, rootsy music industry, and I'm trying to write a novel, so there you go. Is that enough?
Another novelist. Awesome.
Trying.
Well, isn't everybody trying? Well, I shall join you in the dram steak with an Ardbeg 10-year-old. Yeah.
We're staying on Islay tonight.
Yeah. It's just one of my favorite, you know, areas for a good single malt. I think there's about 8 or 10 distilleries there now, and each one has its own distinct take on the whiskey, you know. So it's but I find that Ardbeg 10 is just one of these go-tos whenever you want a good solid, you know, single malt.
You like them peaty?
I do like them peaty, yep.
I get that. The only, I gotta tell you, the only thing that I don't like about the popularity of Islay malts in the world of Scotch is that I think that there's a fair amount of machismo about how peaty and how Listerine-y you I like my whiskey with like 9 million parts per million of peat in there, and it's got to be the biggest, smokiest, peatiest, most astringent whiskey you can ever have. Sometimes gets a bit tiresome for me.
And you know what? We went there, my friend and I, Sam Friarella, went there last year, and we found Laphroaig was very much like that. All the other distilleries were really good, like Brugladdy, Ardbeg, Bomore, all these guys were really good. But we found Laphroaig was just wanting to be the peatiest that they could be. So yeah, I completely get that.
Yeah, it's just, and I mean, I get that, but for me, it's just, do I enjoy it? It doesn't have to be the most of anything.
Exactly. Now, you'd mentioned that you're very heavily, and I think this is maybe one of the ways we first met, actually, but you mentioned you're heavily into the folk music scene, mm-hmm. And the music scene in general, especially in Ottawa. And I know I don't know if you still do them, but you used to do these house concerts. Is it the Barncat house concerts?
Or? Yes, yes. We were on hiatus for about a year and a bit, but we are back doing that, and we've got one coming up in March.
Now, how does that work for people that aren't aware of it?
House concerts are I don't know if they're the best kept secret, because I'm not sure just how secret they are, but they are a wonderful little piece of community building and community making focused around music. They're part house party. They take place in somebody's home. They are part kitchen party. There's music and they're centered around music. But they're also a really important part of the ecosystem for folk and roots musicians who want to make a living as touring artists, because the way that these work tends to be that an artist comes to someone's house and they get all of the money that's collected. So in our case, we suggest a donation for the artist. Usually it's around $20. So everybody who comes usually brings $20, and that takes care of the artist. So we've had up to 65 people in the house for one memorable show. People bring it. We do sort of potluck desserts and snacks. And so people come and they have some mingling and have a drink, have some food. And then the artist starts to perform, and it's a concert setting. So people are there to listen. And then hopefully they'll buy a CD or some merch and they go home. Usually the artist will stay with us if they're from out of town. And then off they go to their next gig, and we have some great memories.
And this is all at your own house, right? Or it's at the house of the hosts?
No, some people will do them at other people's houses, but we've always done ours here at our place.
And nobody's ever trashed you? You've not had like a Mick Jagger kind of thing going on there? Or?
We have had one artist who my partner, Kathy, has said, I really would rather not have that person back. And it wasn't that they trashed the place. It was just that they weren't her cup of tea as a house guest. And but other than that, it's magical in a whole bunch of ways. I've seen a lot of people brought to really heavy emotional states by songs that they hear, just because of the proximity. I mean, this is an event where you're like 15 feet away from potentially one of your favorite musicians, and you're watching them perform in an incredibly intimate environment. And so it can get pretty emotional, and it's gotten emotional for artists at times too, where they've both good emotions and bad emotions. We've had artists who have come and been scared out of their wits by being that close to crowds because they're used to playing in a bar environment. So being in front of people who are visible to them and that they can sort of see them paying attention can be intimidating for the artist. And for me, I get this sort of very selfish thrill of getting to say, like, I really like this person, so I'm going to invite them to play at my house, and then they're going to come and I'm going to watch them. It's amazing.
Yeah, I can all imagine. I mean, the closest I ever came to that, not in my own house or anything, but when I first moved to Canada and I was going through the whole paperwork thing, you know, for permanent citizenship, etc., I used to write for a freelance indie music publication online. And one of the guys that was touring from the UK was a singer-songwriter called Tom McRae, who I just loved. He was one of my heroes in the UK. And I got to interview him and see him play a really intimate set in front of like about 60 people. And it was just incredible. It was one of these, you know, crap, I've arrived moments. You know, it was amazing, that just the emotion. So I can only imagine what it's like in your own environment, your own home, with these people, A, on stage, and B, enjoying it around you because you've organized it.
The one danger is that it can kind of ruin you for big shows. I have a really hard time going to stadium size shows or hockey arena shows now, because it's just everything is so far away and everything is so programmed and so technical, and it just, you don't get the connection between you and the artist, and you don't get to feel that connection between the audience. I think there are people who can do that in huge environments, but it's a very special trick.
Yeah, I think maybe Springsteen's one of the masters of that, where it feels like he's singing just to you at that time.
I've also heard Ed Sheeran is really good at that. I've never seen him do a show, but I've heard that he's really amazing at that.
I can imagine, yeah. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you about on the same subject, ukulele. Why the ukulele?
Why not the ukulele?
Touché.
It was a house concert that got me into ukuleles. We invited a artist named David Newland to play at the house. And David is a really fascinating guy. Actually, you should talk to David Newland. You should have him on this. He would be great. David is an adventurer. He currently does a number of cruises every year with Adventure Canada, where he is a musical Zodiac driver. So they will go through the Northwest Passage, and he'll bring along some instruments and play songs and tell stories about the North and the Northwest Passage, and drive the Zodiac for excursions. But he was also, when we had him here at the house the first time, he was also one of the founders of the Corktown Ukulele Jam in Toronto. So he was going through an infatuation with the ukulele. And he brought this, you know, the Dire Straits record, Brothers in Arms?
Mm, yeah.
With that beautiful National Steel guitar, the dobro, on the cover?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So he brought along the ukulele version of that. So a resonator ukulele. And I was really intrigued by that particular instrument. And not too long after that, I discovered that a friend of mine had one that he had never taken to. He had played it a couple of times, and then it just sat in his case and he had no interest in it anymore. So we made a deal, and I bought my friend's resonator uke, and that just kind of sent me down the ukulele rabbit hole. And I love it. I love you. I started out as a guitar player. That was the first instrument that I ever learn to play. But one of the things that I like about the ukulele is that there are transferable skills between it and guitar. So there were things that I was able to bring over from that I knew on guitar. But one of the things about the instrument is that with only four strings, you can make really sophisticated chord structures that are very close in fingering. So you can get quite sophisticated on a ukulele in terms of what you're playing, but you don't have six strings, you only have four to deal with. So one of my favorite things to play on uke is old Great American Songbook stuff. So Duke Ellington, Gershwin tunes, all of those sorts of old tunes. And they're not sort of G, C, D, you know, 1-4-5 rock and roll chords. These have like these seventh chords with flat fives and flat nines and all of these crazy things. But I can do it on uke more easily than I can do it on a guitar. And it just appeals to me. You hold the uke higher up on your body than you do a guitar. So I think that the sound is closer to your head so that you hear it more clearly. And if you have a nice uke, and I'm lucky enough to have a couple of ukes that I really like, they just have really sweet, gentle tones to them. I really love the sound.
I remember seeing the great Scottish comedian Billy Connolly come out with his uke, and I think that's where I first, you know, no offense to yourself as a ukulele player, but I think that's when I first realized the ukulele was such a versatile instrument that could make such beautiful sounds, you know, and just to watch his fingers move across the strings and the sound come out was just mind-blowing.
And the other fascinating thing, and at some point I swear I'm going to do like a radio documentary or something about the history of the ukulele. So everybody thinks the ukulele is Hawaiian, but it's actually Portuguese.
Hmm.
In the 1800s, a whole pile of Portuguese sugar cane plantation workers were brought over to Hawaii to help establish the sugar industry in Hawaii. And they brought this tiny little four-stringed guitar-like instrument with them. It wasn't a ukulele yet. It was similar to a ukulele. And the Hawaiians got a hold of these instruments, and they started making little modifications here and there. The strings went from steel strings to nylon strings, which changes the sound of the ukulele, and it also makes it a much lighter instrument. And the instrument became Hawaiian. Then in the just after the San Francisco earthquake, there was a big World's Fair in San Francisco to try and reboot the economy there. And the Hawaiians came over with their ukulele music and the grass skirts and the whole, and that was the beginning of the whole Hawaiian craze, right? So people were just enthralled with, you know, beautiful native maidens doing hula hula dances and these little ukuleles. And for about 10 to 15 years, the ukulele was an incredibly popular instrument. And even over in the UK, I don't know whether he would have been as famous in Scotland as he would have in England, but there was a guy named George Formby. And for about 15 years, George Formby was the most highly paid entertainer in the British Isles and a ukulele player, a great ukulele player. And then Formby, there are still huge numbers of Formby nerds out there, and probably the most famous of which was George Harrison. George Harrison was a huge George Formby fan, and the stories go that if you went to dinner at George Harrison's estate, it was guaranteed that after dinner he would start handing out ukuleles, and every night would end with a sing-song.
That is awesome, because we always saw George Formby as a comedian that could play the ukulele, but as you mentioned, he was a very talented ukulele player, and I never knew he was one of the most or the highest paid entertainer because of that.
He was insanely popular, huge, sort of Elvis-level movie. Well, there wasn't TV when he was at his peak, but like his movie grosses were huge. Concert tours, the whole thing. And he was, you can find, if someone's out there, they can look for George Formby, F-O-R-M-B-Y. Go to YouTube, get George Formby on there, and trust me, you'll be blown away by some of the things that he did on the uke. He was an immensely talented guy.
Now, I know, but just switching a little bit in tempo.
Because I'll go down this rabbit hole. It'll be 3 hours from now. Yeah. You'll have done a bottle of scotch. I'll still be talking. It'll go back.
It'll all go crazy. And then I'll have 5 hours of editing afterwards. But I know, and one of the things that I think you and I got together in the first place was, along with our friend Sue Murphy over in Ottawa as well, was 12 for 12K. And, you know, doing good for, you know, the world and doing good projects. And I know you're heavily involved in that. And we recently lost Paul Dewar, who obviously made a huge impact in Ottawa and you know, where you guys live. And what was it about Paul that, for you, made him such a good person? And, you know, why he'll be missed?
That is a really good question. And so I'll give the listeners a capsule bio of Paul Dewar, and it has to start with his mom, who was the mayor of Ottawa. And when the Vietnamese war ended, there was a crisis of Vietnamese people fleeing the country, and they were known as the boat people. And she came up with the idea of a project here in Ottawa called Project 4000. And that the goal of that project was to settle 4,000 Vietnamese families here in the city. And it was a very ambitious goal for the time. She accomplished it. And now we have a really vibrant and wonderful Vietnamese community here in the city. And we owe that to her. Paul was a school teacher and became the member of parliament for a center of the city riding here, and was the MP for 9 years. I got to know him very slightly because of a fundraiser that I host, and he was part of a three-person judging panel for us for that show. And the thing about Paul was that he was tirelessly devoted to causes and to lifting people up, but he did not lift himself up with the same energy. He was very happy to push something forward, but not be at the head of the parade. After he died recently, the same brain cancer that Gord Downie passed away from. And the number of people who said in the wake of his death, you know, Paul would come to this event every year and he didn't want time on the microphone. He didn't want attention drawn to himself. He was there to show support, but he didn't demand attention as a quid pro quo for that. And I think he just built up so much respect and goodwill for that. And he also had, along with those principles, he had a great sense of humor. Probably one of the most famous Canadian political gifts that is out there was he was doing a panel for a CBC politics show. And there was one of his co-panelists, a conservative MP, was going on with some nonsense. And you can see Paul sitting next to him and he just loses his composure and he starts to laugh and he puts his hands up in the air. And then he puts his face in his hands. And he's just shaking his head, and you can see that he's lost patience with this guy's, you know, speaking points, but he's not sort of being angry and outraged. He's laughing about it, and he's doing it in a really good-natured, respectful way. And he was never someone who I think was acquainted with the meanest and the nastiest sides of politics. And I think that, you know, that was part of what drew so much affection towards him from people.
Well, I know that, like, when he passed, and I think he must have wrote his own eulogy and posted it on mm-hmm. Facebook or had it pre-scheduled to go out, you know, when he passed. And I read that, and just reading it, I never knew the man. I never knew him as a politician. I knew him only through, you know, friends like yourself and his passing. But reading that and the comments afterwards showed how much he meant and how such a good man he must have been, I think.
And I just pulled it up because the thing that I loved about it the most, I think, was at the end of the essay that he wrote for his own death. He said, smile and play, laugh and dance, give and share. And it's like, that was what he did. And that's a pretty good set of marching orders, I figure.
I think that's something we can all live by, especially in, you know, as you mentioned earlier, that today's nastier side of politics and the divisiveness we seem to be getting dragged into.
Yeah, and he never let himself get dragged into that. He was fearless and tireless, but I don't think he ever gave in to that sort of the worst parts of that life.
No.
And that's why he was so loved and respected. Yeah.
Now, I think, and just before wrapping up, Bob, because I mean, I could you mentioned earlier we could speak for hours and drink scotch and just be crazy. And I'm pretty sure we'll do that when I come over to Ottawa. But just before we wrap up this week's show, there's something I wanted. It kind of ties on to what you mentioned about Paul, and that's your Turnstile Moment podcast, which seems to tie into people's life-changing moments, or when they realize that they're at a sort of, you know, a point in life where they can either go left or right. There's no real straight ahead line. Do you want to talk about that and what brought that about and what your goal is for that?
Yeah. It's interesting because I've been in a bit of a holding pattern around that. And I'll tell you, about the podcast, and then I'll tell you why I've been put it on hold a little bit. The idea came from things that have happened to me personally. So one of those is that when I was an early adolescent, I lost a brother. And I think that I always imagine myself being on one sort of path before that happened. And for better and for worse, that path diverting after that happening. And again, when I was 40, I got diagnosed with bladder cancer, and that marked one of these sort of turning points, and things changed. The house concerts grew out of that. My working life changed because of that. And there were a whole bunch of changes. And I always think that we all have those moments in our lives, and sometimes they're a huge, you know, neon signpost saying things are going to change now. And sometimes they're much more subtle. But we all have those moments where things change and you have a choice of going in one direction or in another direction, but things are going to change on the other side of that choice. And so I was interested in those in my life, and I was interested in hearing about those points in the lives of others. And so I started doing some of these episodes around the idea of the turnstile moment. And I took a bit of a pause, and I've got a couple in the can that I need to get out. But I was finding myself uncomfortable with how open people were to talk about some of this stuff. And I was finding it really intimate personal stuff. And I was like, oh, geez, I don't know if I want, even, you know, they knew they were being recorded and everything. They knew that this was a podcast and it wasn't like I was secretly doing it, but I was like, man, this is heavy. And I've just sort of, I pulled back a bit from it just because a couple of the things were so heavy that they just made me go like, oh, do I want to keep asking people these questions? Because, and I'm sure, I don't know, maybe you haven't thought about this, but with your podcast, you give yourself the license to ask people questions like this. And no one's making us answer, but because we're human beings and someone asks you a question, you tend to answer it, right? Mm. And it can be a big responsibility. And so I think I stepped back from that responsibility a little bit. And it's funny that you bring it up because it's been on my mind to revisit that. So, you know, maybe this is just a wee turnstile sitting on the ground waiting for me to go through.
Well, I know I listened to Ginny's podcast, and to your point, that was very intimate. You know, with her struggles with the little one that she was trying to bring, you know, into the adoption process. And but you know, I think we need that. I think we've reached a stage where there's so much crap out there. There's so much, you know, fake news, for want of a better description. There's so much lies and deceit. I think people need honesty and people being vulnerable and opening up and showing that we're all like each other. We all have our skeletons, we all have our problems that we need to deal with. And sometimes by opening up these issues, by, you know, chats like this or chats like, you know, your podcast or similar, I think people were looking for that, to be honest. And I know what you're saying, but I don't think you should hold back. I think people will have a filter where they know themselves I don't want to go down that direction. Can we switch track or something? But yeah,
I should have just asked you in the first place if I'd only thought of that.
Well, there's always time.
You can be my sensei.
Yeah, exactly. Well, as I mentioned, I mean, this has been a really great chat, Bob. I'm glad we got together after the first aborted attempt, which was my fault.
I think your first aborted attempt in favor of your daughter's birthday is entirely proper choice.
It's allowed.
Yes,
the second one totally would have been. So for people that want to get to know you better and want to hear more of your stories and perhaps even, apply to be a guest in your podcast, etc., where can they find you online? Where's the best places?
They can find me on Twitter. Most places, I'm Bob Ledrew, B-O-B-L-E-D-R-E-W. Also sometimes known as Bobble Drew by my friends. So you can find me on Twitter and those places as Bob Ledrew. You can look up Bobcat House Concerts, like Bobcat, like the Wildcat, and houseconcerts.com is where you can find information about those. And you can find me at turnstilemoment.com on the podcast.
Awesome. Well, I'll make sure to drop these links into the show notes and make sure people can find you. Okay.
Thank you, Daniel.
No, well, Robert, thank you again for appearing and for bringing a really good scotch with you. I'm impressed. I think you're the only second guest that's actually brought a scotch with them. So I need to start being more strict with the guests.
What a bunch of tossers.
Right? I mean, it's called terrible. Life Through a Dram, not life through like a, a fruitini. So
life through a tea.
Exactly. All righty. Well, I'm going to cheers you with a final sip, and we will speak soon.
Slanjivar.
And thanks again, guys, for listening to another episode of Life Through a Dram. I hope you're continuing to enjoy it. And remember to subscribe on your favorite platform. A review is always good. And if you feel people would enjoy it, feel free to share with anybody else. Take care, and we'll see you next week. Slanjivar.
This has been Life Through a Dram. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode.